the account from an anonymous LLC via a small Swiss bank called BSI SA. In 2016, BSI was one of several companies that were part of an embezzlement and money laundering investigation spanning 10 countries and at least $4.2 billion in irregular transactions. The financial documents also demonstrate that someone in the Biden family has other LLCs set up to receive payments. In August 2015, for example, $150,000 was transferred into an account controlled by something called MFTCG Holdings LLC Biden. It is unclear what that account is or who controls it. In another corporate record released as part of the court trial, Devon Archer describes a financial relationship with Russian oligarch Yelena Baturina, a billionaire with extensive political connections in Moscow and notorious links to Russian organized crime. Archer said Baturina invested $200 million into various investment funds with which he was involved. Not all of Hunter Biden's wealth accumulation during his father's vice presidency was international. Some deals occurred within the United States and benefited from taxpayer dollars steered by his father's closest aides. Consider the case of something called Mbloom, a joint venture that Hunter Biden and Devon Archer set up in Hawaii. Mbloom was a public-private partnership in which Hunter's firm invested $5 million and the other half came from the Hawaii Strategic Development Corporation, or HSDC. But where did HSDC get its money for Mbloom? It came from a program back in Washington, D.C. called the Treasury Department State Small Business Credit Initiative. $3 million of the HSDC money came from the program, which was run by a longtime Biden aide named Don Graves. It's hard to find someone tighter in the Biden orbit than Graves. Over the course of his career, he has served as counselor to Vice President Biden, his domestic and economic policy director, and as his traveling chief of staff. After Joe Biden left the White House, he appointed Graves to the policy advisory board of the Biden Institute. The bottom line is that Hunter Biden's joint venture with Mbloom was partly funded by taxpayer dollars through a program run by his father's longtime aide. Things ultimately did not go well for Mbloom. Almost immediately, the company became embroiled in an ethics scandal when it was revealed that the two men running the fund were steering dollars to their own companies. Beyond his numerous Rosemont-branded entities and ventures like Mbloom, Hunter was also deeply involved with a troubling entity called Burnham Financial Group, where his business partner Devon Archer also sat on the board of directors. As they had with Rosemont, Hunter Biden and Devon Archer used Burnham to make foreign deals with governments and oligarchs, including Nurlan Abdulov, an associate of Kazakh oligarch Kenis Rakishov. As mentioned, Rakishov is the son-in-law of the former vice prime minister of Kazakhstan. His father-in-law, Imangali Tazbegambetov, was also formerly the defense minister of the country and is now the Kazakh ambassador to Russia. Kazakhstan is an important country not only for its vast energy resources, but also because of its geostrategic position. The financial ties between this foreign government and Biden appear to go deeper than just the investment in Burnham. As one business associate put it in an email released at the court trial, Rosemont is deeply involved in Kazakhstan. The SWF, or Sovereign Wealth Fund of Kazakhstan, is involved with Rosemont Seneca Technology Partners, Rosemont's technology investment vehicle. Between the Rosemont entities and Burnham, Biden and Archer's business dealings in Kazakhstan were extensive, although specific financial data remains undisclosed. What can be discerned from emails obtained through the Freedom of Information Act, or FOIA, is that there was back-channel communication between Kazakh officials and then-Secretary of State John Kerry via Devon Archer. Recall that Kerry's stepson, Chris Hines, was a business partner with Biden and Archer in some of their ventures. In an email from July 11, 2013, Kerry Chief of Staff David Wade writes to Devon Archer, "Devon, understand you spoke to the secretary, RE having him call Kazakh Foreign Minister Idrisov today. Can you let me know topics Idrisov wants to talk about, any requests he'll have of the boss, so we can get paper prepared for a call? Hopefully the situation on the home front will leave him time to do it." This email alone makes clear that Archer had direct access to the Secretary of State, without the knowledge of his chief of staff, and that Archer acted as a liaison for the Kazakh Foreign Minister with the Secretary of State, all the while receiving funds for his and Hunter's private deals. In addition, two Chinese companies also became involved with Burnham. Kirin Global Enterprise Limited, a mysterious investment vehicle run by Zhang Yao or Yao Jun Larry Liu, and Guo Yunfeng was one that invested in Biden's company. Very little is known about Kirin or its two principals, other than the fact that they invest heavily in mainland Chinese real estate. Another firm, Harvest Global Investors, a Chinese investment firm linked to the government in Beijing, also worked with Burnham, although it is unclear whether they invested money. Kazakhstan and China aside, Burnham Asset Management became the center of a federal investigation involving a $60 million fraud scheme against one of the poorest Indian tribes in America, the Oglala Sioux. Devin Archer was arrested in New York in May 2016 and charged with orchestrating a scheme to defraud investors and a Native American tribal entity of tens of millions of dollars. Other victims of the fraud included several public and union pension plans. Although Hunter Biden was not charged in the case, his fingerprints were all over Burnham. The legitimacy that his name and political status as the vice president's son lent to the plan was brought up repeatedly in the trial. The scheme was explicitly designed to target pension funds that had socially responsible investing clauses, including pension funds of labor union organizations that had publicly supported Joe Biden's political campaigns in the past. Indeed, 8 of the 11 pension funds that lost their money were either government employee or labor union pension funds. Joe Biden has a long-standing alliance with labor. He closely identifies with organized labor. "I make no apologies," he has said. "I am a union man, period," and many public unions have endorsed him over the years. The defrauded pension funds included Birmingham, Alabama Waterworks Pension Plan, Chicago Transit Authority, Management International Longshoremen's Association, Milk Drivers Local 246, an affiliate of the Teamsters, Omaha, Nebraska School Employees Retirement Fund, Philadelphia Housing Authority, City of Richmond, Virginia Retirement System, Washington Suburban Sanitary Commission. Transcripts from Devin Archer's trial offer a clearer picture of Hunter Biden's role at Burnham Asset Management, in particular the fact that he used his father's name and political status as a means of both recruiting pension money into the scheme and alleviating investors' concerns. Hunter Biden had an office at Burnham's New York City offices on 57th Street. During the trial, numerous witnesses came forward describing Hunter's involvement with the firm. Tim Anderson, a lawyer who did legal work on the issuance of the tribal bonds, recounts seeing Hunter while visiting the Burnham office in New York City to meet with Bevin Cooney, who was later convicted in the case. The political ties that Biden and Archer had were considered key to the Burnham brand. As stated in an August 2014 email, Jason Galanis, who was convicted in the bond scheme, agreed with an unidentified associate who also thought the company had value beyond capital because of their political connections. In the closing arguments at the trial, one of Devin Archer's defense attorneys, Matthew Schwartz, explained to the jury that it was impossible to talk about the bond scheme without mentioning Hunter Biden's name. Mr. Archer responded to further questions. They wanted to know about this too, and one of the reasons, by the way, it was perfectly sensible, was because Hunter Biden was part of the Burnham team. You remember that. You saw on that Teneo slide deck he was going to be the vice chairman. You heard testimony that he was in the office. Mary Moynihan from the BIT board told you they had questions about his commissions and how much he was going to bring in terms of clients. He was part of this deal. It was sensible to talk about him. Beyond son Hunter, other family members saw their commercial fortunes rise as they leveraged Joe Biden's position for their personal benefit. It would be a dream for any new company to announce their launch in the Oval Office at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Startup Health is an investment consultancy based out of New York City, and in June 2011, the company barely had a website. The firm was the brainchild of three siblings from Philadelphia. Stephen Krein is CEO and co-founder, while his brother, Dr. Howard Krein, serves as chief medical officer. Sister Barry serves as the firm's chief strategy officer. A friend named Unity Stokes is a co-founder and serves as president. Startup Health was barely up and running when, in June 2011, two of the company's executives were ushered into the Oval Office of the White House. They met with President Barack Obama and Vice President Joe Biden. "It was an amazing moment," recalled Unity Stokes. "We were pinching ourselves." The following day, the new company would be featured at a large healthcare tech conference being run by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, or HHS. The meetings at the White House were crucial. Afterward, according to Stokes, they felt the wind to our backs. Startup Health would continue to enjoy access to the highest levels of the White House as they worked to build up the business. Indeed, Startup Health executives became regular visitors to the White House. According to 2011 White House visitors' logs, Howard Krein attended the China State Dinner, a White House staff barbecue, and President Obama's Motown event. His brother Stephen had half a dozen other meetings with White House officials. Executives were back in June 2014 for a meeting with 60 health transformers. Howard even had another visit with President Obama on September 25, 2015. That first White House meeting in the Oval Office would remain an important touchstone for the company and was a key component in the way they presented themselves to potential investors and partners. In 2019, they were still touting it publicly as part of the company's mythology. So how did Startup Health gain access to the highest levels of power in Washington? Their status as a healthcare incubator was hardly unique. In fact, there were 31 similar companies operating in the state of California alone and another 11 in the state of New York. So how did the hookup actually happen? At this point, it is important to point out that the chief medical officer of Startup Health, Howard Krein, is actually married to Joe Biden's youngest daughter, Ashley. I happened to be talking to my father-in-law that day, and I mentioned Steve and Unity were down there in Washington, D.C., recalled Howard Krein. He knew about Startup Health and was a big fan of it. He asked for Steve's number and said, "I have to get them up here to talk with Barack." The Secret Service came and got Steve and Unity and brought them to the Oval Office. Advancing the commercial interests of Startup Health using the Oval Office and Air Force Two would continue over the next half decade while Biden was in office. Dr. Krein, who started dating Ashley in 2010 and married her in 2012, joined the Biden inner circle, even serving as a pallbearer at Beau Biden's funeral in 2015. Startup Health describes itself as an investor in healthcare companies and an incubator. This is no charity. The firm offers to provide new companies technical and relationship advice in exchange for a stake in the business. Newly launched health technology companies that want help from Startup Health are expected to offer the firm 2 to 10% equity in their company. Demonstrating and highlighting the fact that you can score a meeting with the President of the United States certainly helps prove a strategic company asset, high-level contacts. Vice President Joe Biden continued to help Krein promote his company through his last months in the White House. In 2016, the Vice President took his son-in-law to the Vatican for a conference on regenerative medicine attended by Pope Francis. Hunter Biden was also on the trip. After arriving on Air Force Two, Vice President Biden gave a keynote speech. Pope Francis also offered his thoughts on the challenges of healthcare and decried profit-driven research. Conference attendees included a who's who of scientific researchers in medicine from around the world. The vice president was still not finished helping to boost his son-in-law's business. The following month, Krein was given the honor of introducing Vice President Biden at a major data conference, first organized by the Obama administration in 2016, called Health Data Palooza. Then in October 2016, Biden made a joint appearance with Startup Health's Steve Krein at the Cleveland Clinic's Medical Innovation Summit. In January 2017, in his final days in the Obama administration, Biden made a surprise appearance at the Startup Health Festival in San Francisco. The corporate event, which is open only to Startup Health members, included the vice president chatting in a closed session with the 250 people in attendance. Once Biden left the vice presidency, he continued to speak for his son-in-law's company. In January 2018, the now former vice president delivered the keynote at the Startup Health Festival. The following year, it was Jill Biden's turn to deliver a speech there. Joe Biden's younger brother, James, has been an integral part of the family political machine from the earliest days when he served as finance chair of his 1972 Senate campaign. Joe and James have remained close. After Joe joined the U.S. Senate, he would bring his brother James along on congressional delegation trips to places like Ireland, Rome, and Africa. James Biden's beach house on Key Wayden Island, Florida, was a Biden gathering place during the vice presidential years. An exclusive island off the coast of Naples, Florida, the 5-acre property became known locally as the Biden Bungalow. During the Christmas 2013 holiday, for example, the vice president and the Biden family gathered there. As might generally be expected, James was welcome as well to the White House, including attending the visit of Pope Francis in September 2015. How many times James Biden visited the White House is not clear, even by examining the White House visitors' logs. In 2011, for example, he was photographed attending a state dinner at the White House, but his name did not appear in visitors' logs for the event. Where James Biden's visits to the White House become pertinent to this analysis is where Joe secured James's inclusion at important White House functions that dovetailed with James's overseas business dealings. As we will see, James Biden's commercial opportunities flourished when his brother became vice president, continuing to show a pattern of Joe's public power being leveraged for his family's material gain. As with Hunter and Ashley, James profited handsomely during Joe's tenure as vice president. Consider the case of Hillstone International, a construction firm created in 2010 as a subsidiary of Hill International. Hill International began losing money in 2011. It had been launched back in 1976, and founder Irv Richter quickly became a major campaign contributor to the New Jersey Democratic Party. He was not shy about the fact that political connections had built his construction business. As he once told the Philadelphia Inquirer, "If your competition has access because they've been political contributors and you don't, you're going to be at a serious disadvantage." The president of Hillstone International was Kevin Justice, who grew up in Delaware and was a longtime Biden family friend. He was friends with lots of Bidens, especially Joe's sons Hunter and Beau. On November 4, 2010, according to White House visitors' logs, Justice visited the White House and met with Michelle Smith in the office of the vice president. Smith was an advisor to the vice president. Less than 3 weeks later, Hillstone announced that the vice president's brother James would be joining the firm as an executive vice president. James appeared to have little or no background in housing construction, but that did not seem to matter to Hillstone. His bio on the company's website noted his 40 years of experience dealing with principals in business, political, legal, and financial circles across the nation and internationally that enable him to understand the needs and perspectives of government, financial, and development leaders to effectively negotiate and implement low-cost housing objectives both domestically and abroad. His company bio added that at the age of 22, James Biden was the finance chairman of his then 29-year-old brother's bid for a U.S. Senate seat in Delaware, and successfully enlisted the support of national unions, political leaders, and financiers across the country. James Biden was joining Hillstone just as the firm was starting negotiations to win a massive contract in war-torn Iraq. 6 months later, they announced a contract to build 100,000 homes. It was part of a $35 billion, 500,000-unit project deal won by Track Development, a South Korean company. Hillstone also received a $22 million U.S. federal government contract to manage a construction project for the State Department. David Richter, founder Irv's son, was not shy in explaining Hillstone's success in securing government contracts. "It really helps," he told investors at a private meeting, "to have the brother of the vice president as a partner," according to someone who was there. David Richter talked about having James Biden on the payroll and what it meant. "He knows how to deal with government officials. That's his skill," he said. "He makes people from foreign countries comfortable we're not going to steal their money. After all, he's also been with his brother a long time." The Iraq project was massive, perhaps the single most lucrative project for the firm ever. In 2012, Charlie Gasparino of Fox Business reported that Hillstone officials said that the Iraq project was expected to generate $1.5 billion in revenues over the next 3 years. That amounted to more than three times the revenue the company produced in 2011. A group of minority partners, including James Biden, would split about $735 million. "There's plenty of money for everyone if this project goes through," said Irv Richter. A South Korean construction company won the contract on which Hill and Hillstone would work. Only months after the deal's announcement, James Biden and his wife Sarah showed up at the White House as guests for an official state dinner. It just happened to be a state dinner honoring the then president of South Korea, Lee Myung-bak. The deal was all set, but Hillstone made a crucial error. In 2013, the firm was forced to back out of the contract because of a series of problems, including a lack of experience by Hill and Track Development, according to Irv Richter. But it continued doing significant contract work in the embattled country, including a six-year contract with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. James Biden remained with Hill International, which accumulated contracts from the federal government for dozens of projects, including projects in the United States, Puerto Rico, Mozambique, and elsewhere. The Bidens leverage political power not only for generating deals, but also for the opportunities to quietly develop the financial resources of wealthy friends for the benefit of the family. Friends that help the Bidens can count on Joe to grant them governmental favors. Consider the case of a businessman named John Hynansky. A car dealer from Delaware, Hynansky and his family have officially poured tens of thousands of dollars into Joe Biden's campaign coffers over the years. More than just a donor, he is a Biden friend and has helped the Biden family out financially as well. On July 22, 2009, Vice President Biden was in Kyiv, Ukraine, as part of his first visit to the country during the Obama administration. A large crowd of citizens and businessmen gathered on a beautiful, warm summer morning to hear him speak. During his speech, Biden singled out John Hynansky as my very good friend, describing him before the large crowd as a very prominent businessman from Delaware. I had breakfast with him the other day. Hynansky is well known in Ukraine. Shortly after the fall of communism, he moved into the country as an automobile importer and car dealer. Hynansky had ambitions to expand his business in Ukraine, and the Obama-Biden administration was willing to help. 3 years after that speech, in July 2012, the federal government's Overseas Private Investment Corporation, or OPIC, announced that it was providing Hynansky's company with a $20 million loan so that he could grow his import dealership in Ukraine. According to OPIC, the loan was to expand Winner Import Ukraine's automobile business and construct and operate Winner Auto City, which will have two new state-of-the-art dealership facilities for Porsche and Land Rover Jaguar automobiles. What is unusual, and as OPIC made clear, is that the loan would not actually create any American jobs. The cars to be sold in Ukraine were European luxury vehicles built in other countries. The best it could claim was that the taxpayer-backed loan would not cost any American jobs. The Biden family friend benefited from taxpayer-backed loans provided by the Obama-Biden administration. Why Hynansky needed the loans is unclear, given his vast business empire. Indeed, in 2015, Hynansky told reporters, "I have a ton of companies in the Ukraine." Why OPIC granted a taxpayer-backed loan for a business that would not create jobs in the United States and would simply sell expensive European-made vehicles to the Ukrainian elite is also unclear. What is clear is that Joe Biden helped a friend who would later help another Biden. In June 2015, James Biden had a federal tax lien placed on the Biden bungalow on Key Wayden Island, Florida, by the Internal Revenue Service, or IRS. According to tax filings, he owed nearly $590,000 to the federal government in back taxes. In late 2014, there was also a $74,700 lien placed on the home by a contractor called Gator Pressure Cleaning and Custom Painting. In mid-2015, help arrived when James received two mortgages totaling $900,000. The mortgages came from an obscure Delaware entity called 1018 PL LLC. According to corporate records, John Hynansky controls that company. The mortgages Hynansky provided seemed to do the trick. The amount James owed to the IRS dropped to just $30,000 by the end of 2015. 6 days after he received the mortgages from Hynansky, Gator was paid too. Even after Joe left office, James Biden continued to tout his ties to his brother. At a meeting in 2018, James told a group of potential business partners that the Biden Cancer Initiative, a nonprofit launched in 2017 by Joe and Jill Biden, would help promote their new business. In July 1999, Joe's other younger brother, Frank Biden, was living in San Diego and driving, with a suspended Florida license, a rented Jaguar XK8 sedan. On August 14, 1999, Frank drove the Jag to a friend's house and later, around 11:15 p.m., they decided to go to a concert at the Belly Up Tavern in Cardiff, California. According to court documents, he gave the keys to his young friend Jason Turton. Three others piled into the back seat. Frank rode shotgun, handled the stick shift, and provided instructions as they cruised down the highway. At one point, Frank shifted into high gear and told Turton, "Punch the car and leave it in third gear until told otherwise." Frank then gave the command for fourth gear, and the Jaguar picked up speed. Soon they were humming along between 70 and 80 miles per hour in a 35-mile-per-hour zone. Michael Albano, a 37-year-old single father, was crossing the street, having just left a beachside bar when the Jaguar slammed into him. Albano was first struck by the right headlamp, which sent him crashing into the windshield over the top of the car, into a backseat passenger's face, and then onto the Jaguar's trunk before landing on the asphalt. In depositions, two of the witnesses sitting in the back seat recall Frank Biden telling Turton to keep driving after Albano hit the ground. Albano died at the scene. He left behind two young daughters who would later describe him as a perfect father. Turton pleaded guilty to felony hit and run. The guardians for Albano's daughters sued Frank Biden in court in a wrongful death civil lawsuit on August 14, 2000, but Frank never showed up at the courthouse. Nor did he reply to any legal correspondence from the court, including a court final judgment in September 2002 that Frank owed each of the girls $275,000 for his role in the tragedy. In October 1999, the guardians for the two Albano girls had hired a private investigator to find Frank. They spoke to his ex-wife, the broader Biden family, and eventually the Biden family attorney, who refused to provide any information about Frank's whereabouts or to accept service of documents. Investigators also noted that they had received information indicating that the subject appears to stay with his brother Joseph occasionally, and that people nearby claimed to have seen him at Joe's house in Delaware. The quest for paying the judgments began. Investigators could not find any bank accounts connected to Frank because of his apparent evasive actions. They suspected that perhaps he had accounts in another name or DBA. 8 years after the court's ruling in September 2008, an attorney for the girls reached out to Senator Joe Biden in Washington, asking for assistance in locating his brother and getting him to pay the debt. Joe Biden, of course, had lost his own wife and daughter in an automobile accident, so perhaps there was the hope that he would be sympathetic. Joe Biden did not respond. Instead, his chief of staff at the time wrote back in what can only be described as a businesslike, even cold letter, revealed publicly here for the first time. Senator Biden has received your letter of September 16th regarding a judgment by your clients against his brother Frank, he wrote on Biden's official Senate stationery. The senator wishes to express his deep sympathy with the Albano daughters over their loss. While it is correct, as you state, that Senator Biden was not involved in the accident and bears no legal liability for the judgment, the senator would certainly encourage his brother to pay the judgment if his personal financial circumstances made that at all possible. As you are aware, however, Frank has no assets with which to satisfy the judgment. The senator regrets that this is where matters stand and that he cannot be more helpful. But Frank Biden was earning money. Indeed, 7 days before Joe Biden's office sent that letter, his brother was slapped with a tax lien from the IRS for $23,638.59 in unpaid taxes. In total, he owed more than $32,000 at the time, a clear indication that Frank had income. In 2013, he paid off the tax lien in full. As of the time of this writing, in September 2019, the Albano daughters have still not collected their money from Frank Biden. With interest, that judgment debt is now more than $900,000. As we have already observed, loyalty to family is a virtue until it becomes an excuse for unethical use of public power. Here, we also note the irony that loyalty to his family would become an excuse to disregard someone else's family, despite having the power to take compassionate action for a just cause. Although Joe appears unwilling to help the Albano sisters collect a legitimate debt from Frank, as we will see, he has been busily helping Frank accumulate wealth through far-flung business deals. In late March 2009, Vice President Joe Biden was headed to Costa Rica aboard Air Force Two. He went for a series of meetings with officials as a preamble to the Fifth Summit of the Americas Conference. Biden went to the Costa Rican Presidential Palace for a one-on-one with President Oscar Arias. Daniel Ortega, the strongman leader of neighboring Nicaragua, criticized Biden for being too chummy with Arias. The Biden visit had symbolic significance. The last time a high-ranking American official had visited the country was back in 1997 when Bill Clinton had come. Biden and Arias met with a number of associates present. Biden invited Arias to work with him personally to develop education policy for Central America, but also underscored that foreign direct investment would help Costa Rica's economy more in the short term. During the meeting, Arias gave Biden a letter to pass on to President Obama requesting additional U.S. aid dollars to assist with Costa Rica's education system. Later, the Arias administration declared that it was a clear recognition of the trajectory of Costa Rica as the United States' strategic partner in the region. Joe Biden's trip to Costa Rica came at a fortuitous time for his brother Frank, who was busy working deals in the country. Conveniently, any assets Frank might hold in Costa Rica would be out of reach of U.S. courts and the Albano family. Frank, who had studied law and practiced real estate in Florida, had ambitions in Costa Rica. In the months that followed, the opportunities for Frank Biden arose courtesy of the Costa Rican government. Just months after Vice President Biden's visit in August, Costa Rican News announced a new multilateral partnership to reform real estate in Latin America between Frank Biden, a developer named Craig Williamson, and the Guanacaste Country Club, a newly planned resort. The partnership, which appears to be ongoing, was wrapped in a beautiful package as a call on resources available to the companies and individuals to reform the social, economic, and environmental practices of real estate developers across the world by example. Frank Biden declared, "Prioritizing the health and well-being of employees, members of the local community, and protecting the breathtaking beauty that is Costa Rica is a moneymaker." In real terms, Frank's dream was to build in the jungles of Costa Rica thousands of homes, a world-class golf course, casinos, and an anti-aging center. The Costa Rican government was eager to cooperate with the vice president's brother. As Joe Biden would later recount in his book, Promise Me, Dad, he was a central player in Obama administration policy toward Latin America and the Caribbean. "The president asked me to take over the job of repairing our wobbly relations across the entirety of the Americas, the Northern Triangle, Brazil, the Caribbean, everything. He was the go-to guy in the White House for Latin America policy." The Costa Rican National Power and Light Company, or CNFL, unveiled the conceptual design for what would later become the Guanacaste Solar Park. The new facility would provide energy for Frank's plans for a massive resort being built just north of the town of Liberia. CNFL picked Frank's company, Sun Fund Americas, as their partner for the solar park. Frank did not have any background in solar energy, but it was quite clear who he was when he pitched the project to investors. His brother Joe's name figured prominently in his biography. Frank's partner in the deal, as in the Guanacaste Country Club, was a real estate investor in Costa Rica named Craig S. Williamson, an American Army veteran who now lived in the country. Williamson was arrested in 2014 for failing to appear in court related to a fraud charge. Long active in selling real estate to Americans in Central America, Williamson describes himself as a Central American real estate investment advisor for many North American-based institutional real estate investors, as well as hundreds of private investors, including the family of U.S. Vice President Joseph Biden. Frank's vision for a country club in Costa Rica received support from the highest levels of the Costa Rican government, despite his lack of experience in building such developments. He met with the Costa Rican ministers of education and energy and environment, as well as the president of the country. Costa Rican President Luis Guillermo Solís Rivera even penned a letter to Frank Biden praising the project. The letter found its way onto the internet, seeking pre-sales for the project to investors back in the United States. On October 4, 2016, the Costa Rican Ministry of Public Education signed a letter of intent with Frank's company, Sun Fund Americas. The project involved allowing a company called Go Solar to operate solar power facilities in Costa Rica. The previous year, the Obama-Biden administration's OPIC had authorized a $6.5 million taxpayer-backed loan for the project. Despite Frank's MIA status concerning the Albano debt, Joe and Frank Biden have remained close over the years. As Frank explains in his bio, "Throughout his career, Mr. Biden worked as an unpaid senior advisor on all of his brother Joe Biden's senatorial campaigns, culminating in the presidential election of 2012. He is currently senior advisor to the former VP's 2020 Political Action Committee." During Joe's tenure as vice president, Frank frequently visited the White House. On May 1, 2014, Frank sat in on a small meeting with Barack Obama in the Oval Office. In 2016, Frank was a guest at the Singapore State Dinner in the White House. Frank's company, Sun Fund Americas, had ambitions beyond Costa Rica. The company states that it teams with governments and local partners and provides debt and equity financing, as well as world-class brands, operators, and equipment suppliers for projects. Here, too, Joe could help. In June 2014, Vice President Joe Biden announced the launch of the Caribbean Energy Security Initiative, or CESI. The program called for increasing access to financing for Caribbean energy projects that he strongly supported. American taxpayer dollars were dedicated to facilitating deals that matched U.S. government financing with local energy projects in Caribbean countries, including Jamaica. In January 2015, Biden hosted CESI in Washington, D.C., bringing together leaders from across the region to discuss energy issues and, in particular, renewable energy. One primary focus of the conference was local and international dealmakers needing help to bring renewable energy projects to the Caribbean region. USAID announced that it would be spending $10 million to boost renewable energy projects in Jamaica over the next 5 years. After Joe Biden brought together leaders for CESI, Brother Frank's firm, Sun Fund Americas, announced that it was engaged in projects and is in negotiations with governments of other countries in the Caribbean region for both its solar and waste-to-energy development services. As if to push the idea along, the Obama administration's OPIC provided a $47.5 million loan to support the construction of a 20-megawatt solar facility in Clarendon, Jamaica. When the deal was announced, U.S. Ambassador to Jamaica, Luis G. Moreno, noted that the project wouldn't be possible without OPIC financing. Frank Biden's Sun Fund Americas later announced that it had signed a power purchase agreement, or PPA, to build a 20-megawatt solar facility in Jamaica. Many of Frank's commercial ventures sidecar with government initiatives driven by his famous brother, and so far, those described have been international. Closer to home, one of Frank's largest business ventures involves education. Just as the lack of a background in large-scale real estate developments did not deter him in Costa Rica, and lack of a background in renewable energy did not deter him in Jamaica, lack of a professional background in education was no roadblock in Florida. In 2008, with his brother on the verge of becoming vice president, Frank became involved in the lucrative commercial real estate side of the charter school movement. His older brother had a history of supporting charter schools in the U.S. Senate. Back in 2001, for example, he co-sponsored the Charters and Choice Bill, one of only 8 Democrats to do so. In the 2008 campaign, the Obama-Biden ticket had vowed to double funding for charter schools. Charter schools are public schools established with taxpayer funding, but, unlike traditional public schools, have greater flexibility in experimenting with different teaching models. Charter school methods have shown significant success in turning around some troubled public schools. Beginning in 2009, there was a lot of taxpayer money available for starting charter schools. As part of the federal stimulus, the Obama-Biden administration made $5 billion available for education innovations, which opened the door to more charter schools. Frank's interest was in the business side of the schools, in particular the underlying real estate associated with them. He discovered early on that charter schools pay rent using taxpayer dollars. Managed correctly, and with the right connections, this created profitable opportunities. In Joe Biden's first year as vice president, Frank became involved with a for-profit management company for charter schools called Mavericks in Education Florida, LLC. Frank says that his involvement grew out of a chance encounter in a coffee shop when he bumped into a South Florida businessman named Mark Rodberg. Mavericks geared schools for at-risk students who had trouble in school. The schools themselves would be nonprofits, but Mavericks in Education Florida, LLC would be a for-profit company that charged the school's management fees, while the related School Property Development, LLC owned and charged high rents for their buildings. The funds would come from taxpayer money and federal grants. Whether the school failed or succeeded, the for-profit company owned the real estate assets. It was not long before Frank was flying around Florida in a private jet, lobbying local politicians and school officials to allow Mavericks to manage charter schools in their communities. Eventually, he became president and director of development for the company. Whenever the company shared his biography for a business proposal, the fact that he was the brother of the vice president of the United States was in the first or second sentence. "I'm a salesman," Frank said. "I'm nothing but a P.T. Barnum for these kids." From 2009 to 2011, Mavericks opened 8 schools in Florida. When Mavericks set up a school in Fort Lauderdale, they acquired the building from a controversial Broward County power broker named Jesse P. Gaddis. Known as Fort Lauderdale's Taxi King, Gaddis had ties to mobsters and major drug smugglers. As a young man, Gaddis was charged and convicted of armed robbery and went to jail. In a later case, he was charged with kidnapping and robbery, although the charges were eventually dropped. Authorities also investigated Gaddis in connection with a drug smuggling operation in which his brother and business partner Donald Gaddis was killed. His brother was found in a shallow grave in southwest Florida. The deal between Mavericks and Gaddis had extraordinarily lucrative terms for Gaddis. Gaddis exchanged the building for a $2 million promissory note attached to the mortgage at an initial interest rate of 12%, lowered to 10% in 2014. The term was originally for 5 years and was twice extended in 2014 and 2017. The first extension reveals that the interest-only monthly payments for the note's second term were nearly $16,700. Mavericks LLC was a business. Are there people making money in charter schools? Absolutely, Frank Biden explained in one interview. I don't apologize for them at all. Just run good schools for kids who need them. Mavericks ran with its own unusual teaching model. Students would interact with teachers for only a few hours a day. The rest of the time, they would sit in front of computers as part of self-directed learning. According to the Florida Department of Education, the performance record of Mavericks schools in Florida was abysmal. These were not what one would regard as good schools for kids. The best performing Mavericks school was in Kissimmee, near Disney World. The graduation rate at that school was just 43% in 2011. Things were worse at Mavericks' other Florida locations. In Largo, the graduation rate was an astonishing 7.2%. In Homestead, it was an incredible 4.5%. The schools continued to receive poor marks from state regulators. From 2009 to 2014, individual schools received declining ratings 3 times and 1 F. The graduation rates also did not really improve over time. In 2019, the Miami Herald reported continued basement-level performance. Mavericks High of North Miami-Dade had a 9% graduation rate. Mavericks High of South Miami-Dade was 13%. Mavericks was also accused by state auditors in Florida of inflating their enrollment numbers. As the South Florida Sun-Sentinel noted, in South Florida, 3 probes released by the State Auditor General's Office in 2013 and 2014 found Mavericks schools in Fort Lauderdale, Pompano Beach, Palm Springs, and Homestead were collecting dollars for students who did not attend the school and not teaching enough hours to meet state requirements. Why inflate the enrollment numbers? The more students enrolled, the more taxpayer funding collected. The key to understanding Frank Biden's business is that the real money was not in the operation of the schools themselves, but in the underlying real estate for charter schools. It's all about the buildings we buy, he explained in another interview. Certainly the operation of the schools isn't profitable. In addition to Mavericks in education, Frank also became a partner in School Property Development, which provided building services to charter schools and owns buildings connected to Mavericks. They were soon building charter schools in West Palm Beach, Royal Palm Beach, Glen Ridge, Pembroke Pines, and elsewhere in Florida. He also lists himself as a partner in Delmarva LLC, based in Washington, D.C. These entities are responsible for over $12 billion in school financing placed with over 200 schools built and operated in Florida, reads his account. His companies provide a turnkey single source of responsibility to acquire, finance, design, build, and lease K-12 public schools. The strategy was charging the schools high enough rent to pay off the mortgage on the property. In Homestead, Florida, for example, Mavericks school building had a market value of just $1.2 million. The school was scheduled to pay $1.75 million in rent over just 5 years. In short, the schools were a vehicle for School Property Development LLC to profit from buying or leasing real estate for rental by Mavericks in Education LLC. Because the schools were using taxpayer money and receiving grants to pay for the buildings, they were probably less concerned with the rent. By 2014, the Mavericks schools had received more than $70 million in state money. $9 million of that went to the management company. As we will see, the Obama administration also lavished the failing Mavericks schools with federal grants. During this time, Frank enjoyed access to the highest levels of the White House. Indeed, on May 1, 2014, He attended an education event at the White House with top education officials from the National Education Association. That day, he was in a small meeting of just 10 people with President Barack Obama in the White House to talk about charter schools. Other participants included Stephen Biddle, a Florida real estate developer who would later become the chairman of the Florida Democratic Party. Getting a charter school approved can be a tricky political feat. There is clearly going to be opposition from local teachers' unions, and some politicians are going to be suspicious of who is actually going to be running the school. Frank Biden had an advantage that other competitors did not have: a powerful and famous brother whose name he could leverage. Frank dropped his brother's name and position to vouch for his honesty. When he appeared before the City Commission of Sunrise, Florida in 2015 to pitch a school, he casually explained who he was. According to the official minutes of the meeting, the recorder tells of Frank's testimony, saying, "Whatever he, Frank, does, because of the honor of being the vice president's brother, he has to watch himself. Whomever he was involved with was fully vetted." He never explained exactly how his business activities were vetted and by whom. Was he simply making it up? It is impossible to know. Regardless of what explanation he might provide, he was capitalizing on his relationship as the vice president's brother to confer integrity to his company. In an instance several years earlier, he told skeptical local politicians that his school would work by invoking his family's political power. "I give you my word of honor on my family name that this system is sustainable," Frank said. "This school will be sustainable." Local officials approved the deal. During the Obama presidency, Frank Biden's charter schools received millions of dollars in federal grants. These were discretionary grants given through the U.S. Department of Education's, or DOE's, State Educational Agencies, or SEA, grant program. Applications were filed with Education Department headquarters in Washington. As of 2012, the department was sending each Maverick school approximately $250,000 a year in taxpayer money. In 2015, Maverick's schools received just under $2.7 million in grants from the DOE, an average of almost $300,000 per school. Shortly after he announced his 2020 campaign for president, Joe Biden was on the campaign trail in Texas. He told a crowd, "I do not support any federal money for for-profit charter schools, period," Biden said to the crowd's approval. "The bottom line is it siphons off money from public schools, which are already in enough trouble." He never mentioned Frank's profitable charter school businesses and, ironically, the legitimacy that his own name gave them. On June 4, 2019, presidential candidate Joe Biden released a campaign video announcing his views on how to deal with climate change. Joe explained that his plan provided for an enormous opportunity to hold polluters accountable for the damage they have caused, particularly in low-income communities and communities of color. On the same day, about 1,600 miles from Joe, who was campaigning in New Hampshire, Brother Frank stood before the assembled media in South Florida with a similar message. He too was making an announcement concerning pollution and communities of color. But Frank was part of a legal team that was suing 12 sugar growers in a class action lawsuit. The tenor was remarkably similar to what his brother had spoken about in his campaign video. The Berman Law Group in South Florida hired Frank in 2018 to serve as a senior advisor. "He brings a prestigious combination of accomplishments and experience," the firm noted in a press release. They said of Frank, "He is highly regarded in the business and government sectors and boasts one of the most respected names in the U.S. and abroad." The Berman Law Group features as its Director of Government Relations former Democratic Florida State Senator Joseph Abruzzo, who had worked with then-Vice President Joe Biden on legislation. Frank had never filed a legal case before. On that day, the Berman firm filed a class action lawsuit against the United States Sugar Corporation and 11 other defendants on behalf of poor minority residents in Belleglade, Pahokee, and South Bay, Florida, who claimed that they had suffered health problems related to the burning of sugarcane fields. To help make their case, the law firm released a 6.5-minute video/infomercial about the lawsuit. Frank figured prominently throughout and finished it off by walking with the group in slow motion, wearing black sunglasses, through a ring of fire while dramatic music played. Biden's campaign video appeared to be perfectly synchronized with his brother's lawsuit. When asked by a reporter at his press conference whether he had coordinated his announcement with that of his brother, Frank explained, "There was absolutely no coordination. It was serendipitous that Joe's environmental policy came out today. Our thoughts are the same, but there was no coordination. The environmental plan that Joe Biden unfurled in his campaign video had policy nuggets that would help Frank's businesses in very specific ways. Joe Biden's plan calls for strengthening international collaboration and investment in clean energy infrastructure in the Americas, and supplying clean energy across the entire Central American energy grid and in the Caribbean, which is, of course, what Frank was doing in the region. Coordinated in this case or not, the overall pattern here is that the Biden family members see that Joe's vested public power is convenient for the creation of business opportunities for personal wealth. It would be easier to dismiss these entanglements if they only involved one of the Bidens. The fact that it involves five family members indicates that there is a culture within the Biden family that trades off Joe's power, and Joe appears willing to act on their behalf whenever he can. The Bidens leverage Joe's power to their financial benefit. But as we will hear in the next chapter, others are also prepared to go to extraordinary lengths to leverage their power in creative and destructive ways. 4. Cory Booker. Cory Booker is a rock star senator with a cultivated persona, heroic mystique, and a crowd of celebrity friends. He hangs out with Oprah Winfrey and Spike Lee and does big financial deals with Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg and Eric Schmidt, the former executive chairman of Google. On camera, he performs fits of daring do, including saving people from burning buildings and rescuing puppies. To his admirers, he is a sensei of sorts. He's a vegan and a Rhodes Scholar, and he never touches alcohol or tobacco, notes one admiring journalist. He meditates daily and tweets quotes from Jewish scholars and Buddhist priests. As a senator, Booker has demonstrated a penchant for rhetorical flourish. When U.S. Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh was up for Senate confirmation, Senator Booker famously threatened to break ethics rules by releasing confidential records about him. "This is about the closest I'll probably ever have in my life to an I am Spartacus moment," he declared. The disclosure was far less dramatic than Booker would claim. He knew in advance that the documents had been cleared for release. While on the national stage, Booker has consistently identified himself as a progressive, a reformer, a hero for the people. As he told one reporter back in 2013, "There is nothing in that realm of progressive politics where you won't find me." Yet his meteoric rise, first to Newark City Council member, then to Newark mayor, and now to U.S. senator, has left a trail of enriched friends. Booker's public persona may be well known, but a look at his political climb reveals a politician who has leveraged his power for the benefit of his friends and supporters. Booker himself is knit together as a tapestry of American history. Harvard professor and historian Henry Louis Gates Jr. once tested Booker's DNA for an episode of his PBS show Finding Your Roots. Gates discovered that Booker was 47% African, 45% European, and 7% Native American. Booker himself researched his ancestors and found a remarkable lineage, which seems to inform his pronouncements about national unity. As Booker writes in his book United, "I am descended from slaves and slave owners. I have Native American blood and am also the great-great-great-grandson of a white man who fought in the Creek War of 1836, in which Native Americans were forcibly removed from their land. I am the great-great-grandson of many slaves, and I am also the great-great-grandson of a corporal who fought in the Confederate Army." Booker grew up in the white upper-class New Jersey suburb of Harrington Park, less than an hour outside of Newark. Booker's father poetically described his family in their neighborhood as four raisins in a tub of sweet vanilla ice cream. He excelled in high school as both a student and as an athlete and was named Gatorade New Jersey Football Player of the Year. His athletic prowess and academic skills meant a scholarship to attend Stanford University, where he graduated in 1991. Later, he attended Oxford University as a Rhodes Scholar, where he studied United States history before going on to Yale Law School. At Oxford, his religious views expanded in an unusual manner. Amid the graceful spires, he struck up a close friendship with Hasidic Rabbi Shmuley Botek, who founded the L'Chaim Society, an organization for Orthodox Jewish students. Botek is a member of a unique branch of Judaic teaching that embraces the spiritual teachings of the Lubavitchers. Much of the spiritual guidance came from the work of Rabbi Menachem Schneerson, who died in 1994. Lubavitchers are part of Chabad, a Hasidic sect known for its celebratory approach to the Jewish faith. Booker, although raised Baptist, embraced, at least for a while, the Lubavitchers. When he returned to the United States, he maintained a close relationship with Rabbi Botek. At Yale Law School, he co-founded a Jewish society with a rabbi. Booker visited Schneerson's gravesite, where he reportedly prayed 3 times. It is not clear if there were multiple visits or multiple prayers on one. When scholar Robert Kirvin asked him about the gravesite visit, or visits, later, Booker oddly deflected his answer and avoided the subject. After he graduated from Yale Law School in 1997, the super law firm Skadden, Arps, Slate, Meager, and Flom offered Booker a 2-year fellowship to practice public interest law in Newark. For a $37,000 annual salary, he would be filing complaints against slumlords.